billion people, and you are one of them, and you can make a difference. You are making a difference, and we can create the world that we would like. Let's continue to do the work, be encouraged, continue to strengthen and build community, and spread joy and love and healing and hope to all. I'm Cecil Prescott. You have been listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO-FM. I will speak with you next time. Take care.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Urban League of Portland, celebrating its 80th anniversary as a local civil rights organization. Urban League PDX provides housing, education, healthcare, and career services to local communities. Membership information at ulpdx.org.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. And I want to thank everyone who gave to KBOO during the Out Loud Fall membership drive. But there's never a bad time to support KBOO. You can always click on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or website, or text KBOO to 44321, or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Today's Old Mole is about housing and houselessness. Back in 2015, the city of Portland declared a housing emergency, and 10 years later, the problem is worse than ever. In 2015, the point-in-time count showed about 3,800 people were homeless in Multnomah County. In 2025, county figures show 15,865 people were homeless. Some of that increase is due to improved data collection. Some of it is likely due to increased illness. In 2015, 57% of those without housing had a disabling condition, and the pandemic and the continuing difficulty of accessing healthcare in the U.S. has increased illness and disability across all populations. But most of the increase in houselessness is due to the cost of housing, going up much faster than income. Half of all renters in Portland pay more than 30% of their income in rent, and more than a quarter of renters pay more than 50% of their income toward rent. Nationwide, rents have increased 22% year over year. Incomes have not. Wall Street investors have been buying up lower-cost housing, while apartment complex owners increasingly use algorithms to charge the highest rents possible. Portland has been spending a great deal of money on the problem, but as many reports have argued, and as has been the case elsewhere, it's been spending it unwisely. Rather than solve the problem of lack of housing by providing housing, many cities and the federal government have increasingly criminalized houselessness. While in 2018, the Ninth Circuit Court's decision in Boise stated that it was cruel and unusual to arrest people for sleeping outside when they had nowhere else to go, the Supreme Court's 2023 Grants Pass decision reversed that. Laws in Portland still require there to be enough shelter beds available before the police start arresting campers, but city policy seems to be aiming for just that. As Cynthia Griffiths has reported in Invisible People, the Cicero Institute has been working nationally to promote copy-paste legislation aiming to increase penalties for sleeping in public and to empower police to forcibly remove people from encampments. Policies that, again, the Ninth Circuit Court called cruel and unusual, and that research shows actually increase homelessness. But that criminalizing of houselessness aligns with the financial interests of backers of the Cicero Institute, who have investments in private prison companies, surveillance tech firms, and militarized policing. One of the current U.S. president's many executive orders this past summer was titled Ending Crime and Disorder on America's Streets, and it deceptively blames so-called vagrancy for crime and disorder, potentially opening the door to arresting and incarcerating pretty much anyone in America. A couple of weeks ago, a Fox News host on air proposed subjecting houseless people to lethal injection. All of this is, of course, very bad, but much of it is not new and all of it can be addressed. The National Alliance to End Homelessness is suing the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development over its politicizing of federal housing grants. Portland City Council is studying the model of social housing in which housing is owned and managed by the public or nonprofit entities with a focus on affordability and community benefit. Local activists are campaigning for the Renters' Bill of Rights. The struggle continues. On today's Old Mole, we bring you new and old responses to the problems of housing under capitalism. We'll hear a conversation I had recently with Sandra Comstock, founder and executive director of Hygiene for All, which provides services from and to houseless neighbors, including showers and laundry. Sandra is also on the steering committee of the Welcome Home Coalition, which advocates for policies that address the root causes of the housing crisis. Dr. Comstock holds a PhD in sociology from Cornell University, and she recently released papers on the state of our affordability and homelessness crisis in Portland Metro and Oregon, and on the 2024 performance of Multnomah County housing and sheltering strategies. We'll also revisit a piece from the 2015 Old Mole, just before the official declaration of the housing emergency, with readings from the 1800s, the 1940s, the 1960s, and the 2010s about profits and the housing crisis, about the limits of inclusionary zoning that creates so-called affordable housing, and about struggles for tenant control. And we'll share audio from the Rural Organizing Project podcast, Rural Roots Rising, bringing us audio produced in 2021 by the Ashland High School Truth to Power Club's podcast project, in which they talk with members of the homeless community, home free and homeless rights activists, and the Ashland Chief of Police. As ever, you'll be able to find the audio of this episode and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find more information about segments, as well as links to subscribe to the show and to support KBOO and oppose fascism by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. We turn now to my conversation with Sandra Comstock. Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Sandra Comstock. Sandra is the founder and executive director of Hygiene for All, which provides services including showers and laundry for unhoused people. And she's on the steering committee of the Welcome Home Coalition, which advocates for policies that address the root causes of the housing crisis. Dr. Comstock holds a PhD in sociology from Cornell University and has recently prepared studies on the state of our affordability and homelessness crisis in Portland Metro and Oregon,
and on the 2024 performance of Multnomah County housing and sheltering strategies. Thank you for joining us on the Old Mole, Sandra Comstock.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here. I don't know if I'd call them studies, but they're sort of white papers to help inform people. So they're rougher than an actual study, but they're based on obviously the data that's available.
Your paper on the state of our affordability and homelessness crisis in Portland and Oregon points out that we're seeing funding cuts to housing supports from the federal, the state, the county, the city levels. Can you take us through what those funding sources were providing and how the cuts will impact people?
Okay, well, we can start at the biggest level, which is a federal level. Basically, HUD is the main source of housing vouchers, and they come in different forms like Section 8 that people have heard of. Those are long-term housing vouchers typically, and they help to provide assistance for people to pay their rent so that people are paying no more than 30% of their income in rent. And in this last congressional session, when they did their big, brutal bill, they basically declined to stabilize housing vouchers. So housing expenses are going up and up. So if you don't increase the money to match that, then people lose those housing vouchers. And a National Homeless Law Center estimates of 5 to 10% of Oregonians will lose their housing vouchers due to these cuts. So we're looking at 5 to 10% of Oregonians that are dependent on these housing vouchers to make ends meet, having to lose their stability, their housing, possibly. So that's a big deal. The state legislature also reduced eviction prevention investments from $173 million to $33.6 million. And they've approved $1 billion in cuts to housing assistance over the next biennium. So this is at the same time that they're increasing money that they're funding for shelter. Now, the problem with this is shelter doesn't leave someone housed, and shelter is not really a sustainable way to live over a long period of time, particularly when it's congregate shelter. So you're going to just see more people on the streets, there's no doubt. And even in the last point in time count, I think over a third of people reported being houseless for the first time in their lives. So really, this is a housing crisis. This is a housing affordability crisis. Let's be clear. That's what causes this. And really, we're looking at a massive influx of people that are going to be unhoused. Shelters do not solve the problem. They just sort of hide it away, and not very well at that.
My understanding is that the cost of rent has nationwide has gone up 22% year over year. Income has clearly not gone up at that rate. So housing is becoming more expensive. The support that bridges the gap between income and rent is not being maintained. And so more people are losing their housing, ending up out on the street.
Yeah, there's just a lot of different pressures taking place, both, you know, the lack of construction, but also the lack of public ownership or community trust ownership of land that keeps things out of the market. The market is just not a great distributor. If you're looking for a profit continually through renting to people, the rates are going to go up. They're not going to invest money unless there's a large profit. And another pressure is the AI algorithms now that will evaluate for a property owner what the market will bear, basically, before you're going to lose money. So that can even involve leaving units empty and charging more to keep the prices artificially high. You could actually make more money keeping places empty and renting at higher rates. So that's a real problem.
So the drive for profit is maintaining this cycle of increasing cost for rent. Housing vouchers, while essential in keeping people in their homes, it seems to me are kind of rewarding that, since they are going from public funds through people who need help with assistance back to landlords who are then able to keep their rents high and rising, because their tenants are being subsidized, or because, as you say, they're happy to leave something empty if they can get more money for another unit.
And this is true, but at the same time, we can purchase buildings that are already built, which is actually the cheapest way. It's like, I think, at least 25% less expensive than building a new building and creating more publicly owned housing. And we can do things like social housing like they have in Vienna, where 90% of folks are living in housing that's owned either publicly publicly or by nonprofits, and people love it. But for the moment, if we want to have, you know, not have the rising numbers of people on the streets, we're really going to have to do some housing assistance. And that's what's been cut at the federal level. I already talked about the state level, but at the city level too. I mean, I think they're spending a total of $75 million on shelters, but the new overnight only shelters, which are even less effective, are costing us $25 million this year. And we only invest, he's only investing $5 million in housing assistance. And that's going to cause a massive problem. Basically, like, there was a great story in the Oregonian the other day where people were going out to know people's names on the streets and tout the new overnight only shelters. And they asked one woman about it, and she said that she had tried it and that there were no services there. And she wants to be in a place where she doesn't have to move every morning and change her space every morning like she's already doing on the streets. And basically, like, without services, she thought there was more work and trouble and danger than it was worth. You know, got to imagine what these places are like. It's people living like a few feet from other people on cots, with all their belongings under their bed, and with all the things that come in the middle of the night. Like, I can't sleep with my mom, like, she snores. Then, like, multiply that, and then the kinds of disturbances in the night, and it's just a turnstile situation. And even in the 24/7 shelters, if you're looking at how long people stay in shelters, the congregate shelters themselves, people spend about average of 50 days before leaving, and only 12% of them leave to housing. Whereas if you get somebody into permanent supportive housing, or even the rapid rehousing, which is less intensive, you're getting a voucher plus a little bit of case management, 80% of those people are still housed 2 years later after their subsidy. So, you know, the money is just much better spent. Plus, it's actually less expensive than the majority of shelter that we have in the city.
So more people are getting into shelter off the streets. And yet, because even more people are losing their housing, the problem is just increasing. And the city is pouring money into these shelters, which don't solve the problem and just use up money that could be better spent in providing supportive housing, providing rental support, providing eviction defense, all the things that would keep people in housing and stop right. The problem before it starts or accelerates.
Yeah, whereas rental assistance would cost just a couple hundred dollars a month to keep someone housed, and is the cheapest way to not end up with more houseless people on the streets. Eviction prevention is obviously the cheapest way, and that's what they've cut the most severely, both at the county level and the city level and the state level. And basically that creates a situation where you've got more people living on the streets, which actually costs more, like thousands of dollars more a month per person to support.
And we recently have seen cuts to the county program for supportive housing services. They re-indexed so that very wealthy people would pay a tiny bit less to lower the tax for the wealthy that they were paying. There was pressure for that from the Portland Metro Chamber, from business lobbyists, real estate lobbyists.
Well, I need to be clear, because the big change in funding this year had to do with the Metro government did not predict well the amount of income there was going to be. So the tax cuts are coming next year that were already implemented. And we can go back to that in a minute. But what happened this year and what's been happening each year, the Metro does a analysis to determine how much money they think they're going to be taking in. And each year it's been wildly off. But this year's budget deficit was related to just bad predictions. But coming up this year, we're going to be seeing a reduction in the tax on wealthy households with income over $150,000. They raised it to $150,000 and up to something. And there's a lot of pressure to reduce it further. And this is in a situation where we've got cuts at the state and the federal level, and we can't afford to be doing this. Honestly, like, for the families earning like $150,000, we're talking about the cost of a latte, because it's only the money over $150,000 that they're paying for. So if you earn $160,000, you're paying a 1% tax on $10,000. So this is money well spent, and it's deeply needed, and it's the only thing is going to protect us from the draconian things that are happening at the federal and even the state level. And it's foolish to cut off your nose to spite your face, I guess. I don't know if that's a good metaphor.
How do you understand that? Like, why is this happening? I mean, it seems like the mayor has gotten himself into this. He made a promise he's going to keep it, even though it seems not to be the right solution. And it seems like there are more sweeps happening. Houseless people are being displaced even more than in the past. What do you make of this? How do you understand why this is happening now?
Well, with the mayor, there's a focus on showing something quickly. You know, when we were back in the whole budget sessions, I heard from a lot of the folks on city council that he was elected on this. It was his mandate. And, you know, we're trying to point out, if there's no money to move people into housing, if you're going to spend some money on shelter, you've got to have housing vouchers that match with that to move people through it. If you don't do that, then you're going to have more and more people unhoused, particularly when rent assistance and everything else and eviction prevention is going down. But there's just a real lack of desire. And honestly, like with the sweeps, we ask every person that comes into our hub, when was the last time you were swept? And the number saying within the last 2 weeks has gone from 45% to 67% in the last 6 months. So people are being moved and having their possessions they can't carry with them taken from them every 2 weeks. And you can imagine what that does to people's prospects for jobs, ability to get housing, ability to make appointments, and ability to keep hold of their medications. I mean, I had a guy lose his dentures. He lost his dentures in a sweep. And those can only be replaced every 10 years. So you're really talking about people just being dispossessed of the basic things they need to survive and possibly get themselves out of this situation. The mayor gave more than the people that do the sweeps, allocating more money for that and everything else except for his shelter only plan, his shelter overnight shelter only plan saw cuts. So it's really concerning because it just keeps people in constant motion and it keeps people going through the turnstile of shelter and then back on the streets. I mean, the average number of days that people were able to sustain being in shelter, and this includes the tiny house pods, is 77 days. Whereas people that are put in housing, 80% of them are still housed 2 years later. So you can do the math. And when we made a proposal to shift a lot of the money from this shelter only plan to housing vouchers, and we calculated that we could serve in shelter and housing an additional 800 to 1,000 people than we could if we just did the shelter only plan. And that's because rapid rehousing costs about 98% of what a 24/7 congregate shelter bed costs, okay? 60% of what a pod shelter costs, and 58% of what a motel shelter costs. So people don't realize, but those pod shelters cost approximately $3,000 a month. So
which there are apartments that cost that.
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. So I have two guys that were housed like a year ago in $900 a month apartments. They're paying 30% of their income in rent. And one of them had never had a lease in his life. The other one had been on the streets for 14 years and they're doing great. One of them has been doing like super, like comes to work, does his thing. The other one has like gotten himself mental health counseling and has been able to get on bipolar medication that's significantly helped him improve his life, been able to get away from a domestically violent partner. I mean, these are all the things that can happen in housing that cannot happen in a shelter where you're living cheek by jowl with from 25 to 150 people. My third guy that got housed spent 2.5 years in a congregate shelter waiting for housing. 2.5 years. And I don't know anybody else that's been able to sustain that. And the stories he would tell every day when he came into work were, you know, a new outbreak of bed bugs. Somebody had screamed at him in the middle of the night. Somebody had stolen his things from under his cot. It's just, it's endless. So like people have to understand what it is to live in a congregate shelter with absolutely no privacy and completely vulnerable to the other 100 or so people that are in there.
Welcome Home did a study earlier this year that looked at various cities and the different kinds of responses they had, and that showed that the housing first model, where, as you say, regardless of what other problems someone has, they just get them housing And mm-hmm. then they can deal with their yeah. illnesses, whatever else is going on in their lives, and achieve some stability, as opposed to cities that have shelter first models.
Right.
Like Portland does. So in housing first models, the rate of unsheltered has gone down over the yes, years with that absolutely. Policy. And it's gone the other way with yep. the shelter model.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just much more effective. And I wouldn't call what we have here shelter first. Right now it's shelter only because there's no way out. There's no path out. And the new shelters that the mayor is setting up that he spent $25 million on, these overnight only shelters, they don't have services. Most of them don't even have showers. He's asking for people to volunteer to set up showers for people and stuff. And I'm sitting here going, well, we had all of our public funding cut, all of it. And we're scrambling to figure out how we're going to get through this next year. And meanwhile, the mayor is setting up things and then asking people to magically create the services that already exist. that exist, but have been, you know, sidelined. So yeah, it's a pretty dire situation, especially when 27% of Portlanders are currently paying more than half their income in rent. And a lot of them are paying far more than 30% of their income in rent. And, you know, meanwhile, we've built all this new affordable housing, which is great, but a lot of it was set at 60% area median income, which includes all the people that own homes. So the problem is that people that rent don't have the same kind of income that the people that own homes. So a lot of those 60% AMI apartments are either vacant or they're in arrears, because that price is only a couple $10 or $100 less than what people are paying for market rate rents right now.
So not particularly affordable by most understandings.
So that's where something like eviction prevention and rental assistance could be especially important to preserving those buildings. Because if those buildings go into deep debt and arrears, we will lose that publicly built, publicly funded housing. So these are all points that we made to the mayor. And, you know, just very disappointing to return to, we have to do this first. But no, we don't need to do that first, because people don't need to go through a shelter to get to housing. People can go directly from the streets to housing. Like two of my guys did it. Two people that, again, 14 years on the streets, the other one never held a lease in his life. Not everybody can do that. And some people need permanent supportive housing, but there are a lot of people that are ready to do it, and it costs less. It's more efficient. We'd serve more people. And just even the tens of billions of dollars that we're spending on sweeping people, all of those things are the result of this shelter only approach, because even people that are sleeping somewhere overnight still have to be somewhere during the day. They're still going to be on the streets. You're still going to see them on the streets, and they're still going to have to find a way to eat and rest and do whatever they need to do. Like, people don't realize people spend hours in line for food. They spend hours in their day going somewhere else to do their laundry if they can at a free space. They spend more time looking for going to apply for apartments or apply for assistance for apartments, all the things that people have to do, you know. And the other thing about sweeps in particular is it creates a situation where people are looking to be more remote, more hidden. And what we found in a study we did last year with some PSU students is that the amount of incidence of frostbite and limb loss, fingers, toes, is higher the more that you sweep people, the more that you move them around constantly. They can't keep enough warm, dry clothing, and they're less able to go to get public transportation, to go to hospitals, etc.
People may already be aware, but the life expectancy of people who are living unhoused is much lower. It really contributes to early death, to illness. And the Portland Street Medics noted that 80% of the people on the street have a disability.
Right.
And then people are being swept and losing their medication, and as you know, getting frostbite.
I can tell a specific story of a patron who got tested at our place for hepatitis, tested positive, began her treatment. I think it's only supposed to take a couple of months to get free of it. It took us like a year and a half, because every time she got swept, she lost her medications, her phone. And it got to the point where we were like coordinating with the Old Town Clinic Hep C people to be able to like hold on to her medication and hand them out one at a time, so that she would be able to continue to take that medication. So, I mean, we're talking about the ways in which this seriously compromises, undermines people's health and ability to get healthy. And those aren't diseases that stop at the front door. A lot of those diseases are things that affect overall public health. So as long as we're treating people like this, the rest of us are also going to be impacted by this. It's all related. It's all tied in. And that's the thing is, you know, the other thing that Housing First studies have shown is that medical expenses, the costs of emergency rooms and public health are hugely higher when you're not housing people. Once people are housed, their medical bills go down. And that means a savings for taxpayers there too. And I guess going back to the sweeps plus shelter situation, the mayor said it in his campaign speeches and he's still referencing it. And Councillor Zimmerman recently said it. The whole point of amping up the number of beds, technical beds that exist, is so that they can begin to enforce this camping ban, the ordinance they passed 2 years ago that the court said, if you don't have places for people to stay, it's not reasonable to fine people and jail them for this. And so part of the impetus of this really is to create a situation where they can enforce a law that will cost us even more, because jailing someone costs way more than housing someone. And yet people don't really connect the dots.
It does seem like there's a parallel between what's happening at the state and city level and what's happening nationally, and the sort of vilification of houseless people and general criminalization and funneling of money into private detention centers and spending money on prisons rather than on the things that people actually need.
And rather than spending on things that improve the health and well-being of our entire community. This isn't just improve the lives of those on the streets. Bearing witness to people suffering, bearing witness to people in pain is something that impacts us all. And certainly the health costs are enormous. You know, lots of communicable diseases are being spread because we aren't giving people the wherewithal to keep themselves healthy. And again, this is not about people's as individuals. This is about the fact that we're not providing the amount of housing we need at the prices we need for people to thrive.
It seems like the city's decision to look into social housing represents a positive step that presumably will take some time to bear fruit. Mm-hmm. But the idea of investing in public housing, in housing that will be there for the benefit of the community rather than for the profit of landlords or financial investors, it seems like a much better direction.
Yes. And now the cool thing about social housing is it's not just for low-income folks. It's mixed income. And the idea is that you want to create as much as possible so that everybody is able to afford to live in apartments that match their level of income. And the other cool thing about it is once you've purchased a building and you've paid it off, the rent goes down. In Vienna, you get a bill each month that shows the cost of maintaining the building, the cost of servicing the debt, et cetera, and there's also a lot of collective renter involvement in decision-making over the properties. And there's a lot of attention to making sure that these are amenity-rich spaces. So you've got childcare nearby, you've got medical clinics nearby, you've got grocery shops nearby, and green spaces, all of which, again, improve the overall health and well-being of people, not just the people that use it. It has its massive ripple effects. So social housing is super exciting, and it'll take us a long time to get to 90% of housing being in that place, but we've got to start somewhere. So I'm really excited about that.
The Capital News had a report a couple of months ago that calculated that there is actually ample housing in the state, maybe not in the city itself, but that Oregon does not actually have a lack of housing. What it has is a lack of housing
affordable
that people can afford. Yes.
Yeah. And even here, like in terms of talking about housing assistance, because housing assistance isn't only for permanently affordable housing buildings, it's for market rate units, right? I looked in a couple of months ago and there was like several thousand apartments that were within the range that we could make the difference for housing assistance. So, you know, it's not a situation where we have to build or buy apartments in order to be able to have people housed. It's a mixture of investing in new public housing and then also, you know, supporting people until we get there, because we can't wait till we have all the permanently affordable housing that we need, because that's decades in the making problem.
But we can make a start, for sure.
We can make a start. We can, and we are. Actually, really excitingly, the Portland purchased 3 buildings a couple months back with, I think, a whole total of 224 or so units that are available now. And that's the exciting part about purchase, too, is it's an immediate benefit. And it saves us money in housing assistance, because with rents lower, we don't have to pay as much to make the difference up from what they need in their income. So, yeah.
Well, for listeners who want to find out more, want to weigh in, take action, where would you suggest people look to get involved?
I think a great way to get involved is the Welcome Home Coalition, which is at welcomehomecoalition.org. And they have a take action page. They have a get involved page. This is an organization that is built of community-based providers largely and folks with lived experience. So I sit on the steering committee with folks that are currently housing insecure or have recently been housed. And it's a really great place to build advocacy for social housing, for renters' rights, and also to preserve the supportive housing services measure, which is under attack right now from mostly the Metro Business Chamber. So,
but you think there is room to create some movement still on the supportive housing services measure?
We have a couple of ideas. They're not fully formed yet, but we will be working very hard to, I mean, not just preserve the tax and keep money coming into the coffers where it's needed, but also to improve the governance structure. But we're making some progress, but we need more voices in the room that know how it works and that want it to work better and that are focused on end user experience. You know, everybody else in the world, if you're creating a product, you don't just create a product without asking the people that are going to use it, how they use it, whether it works for them.
Sandra Comstock, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. You know, we've got to keep hope alive. We've got to keep it alive.
And we will. We can push back. We can get people housed. We can help the people who are in need now.
This is all possible. It's completely possible.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was some of Woody Guthrie's Ain't Got No Home, performed by the Orange Circus Band. And before that, my conversation with Sandra Comstock. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You can find links to the Welcome Home Coalition, Sandra Comstock's recent papers on local housing policy, and lots more information on the webpage for this episode at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We turn now to a past Old Mole discussion of these issues in this segment produced by Joe Clement, whom you also heard playing our theme song at the top of the show. This piece was produced in 2015, just before the housing emergency became official.
Oh, I ain't got a home. I was rambling all around. Just a wandering worker. I go from town to town. And the police make me bar wherever I may go. I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road. A hot and dusty road. Millions have gone. And the rich men took my
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and that's about the prettiest version of Woody Guthrie's Ain't Got No Home that I'd ever heard before, sung by a woman from Arkansas, I believe, named Gina Galena, playing the banjo. As Woody himself might put it, it's a funny world we're living in. Scientists are predicting massive droughts, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Dust Bowl. and the rich men are still taking people's homes and driving them from their doors. It happened to me just the year before last. And if you ever thought to take the chance and raise your voice and say, "No, this is my home," you might be told you have the wrong idea about how this world works. Or you may be shouted down or just ignored. And for those who are not able to land on their feet like I was fortunate enough to, the police are still making it hard. So today's well-read read by Fran Michelle hits mighty close to home. She considers why housing justice hasn't been achieved under capitalism, what housing justice is when reasonably and humanely considered, and last but not least, what kind of direct collective action will actually get us the goods.
Good morning. The Well-Read Red has some readings on housing. First, from a 1946 New International essay by Miriam Gould on Profits and the Housing Crisis, Conflicting Interests of Banks, Industry, and Real Estate. Quote, "Way back in 1872, Friedrich Engels made three generalizations about housing under capitalism that remain the key to analysis of the problem today. First, he said, all the sermons liberals and reformists preach to capital about the profitability of low-cost housing are a waste of time. Capital has ignored the mass housing field because greater profits are to be made elsewhere, and profits, not human need, are the sole criteria of whether capitalism produces. Second, the problem of housing is subordinate to the basic question of income distribution. Until the unjust and evil system we have today is ended, planned, healthful living in cooperative, functional, truly human communities is impossible. Third, the general problem of housing can never be solved without resolving the antithesis between town and country. Translated into simple terms, mass housing is impossible without city planning and socialist, regional, and national economic planning." End quote. Next, from a 2014 Jacobin essay by Samuel Stein on New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's doomed housing plan. De Blasio, Stein notes, is an advocate of inclusionary zoning. Inclusionary zoning, as Stein explains, is an extremely popular program among housing experts and advocates and is becoming something like the country's consensus housing policy. Hundreds of U.S. municipalities have adopted this approach, including Boston, Washington, D.C., Denver, San Diego, and San Francisco. The details vary from case to case, but the idea is for private developers to incorporate some percentage of below-market-rate units into their new developments. These units can be rented or sold as long as they are targeted toward households with specific income brackets. But, Stein argues, inclusionary zoning is a flawed program. It's not just that it doesn't produce enough units, or that the apartments it creates aren't affordable, though both observations are undeniably true. The real problem with inclusionary zoning is that it marshals a multitude of rich people into places that are already experiencing gentrification. The result is a few new cheap apartments in neighborhoods that are suddenly and completely transformed. Advocates for the houseless have also challenged the value of inclusionary zoning, noting that it will do nothing for those in the shelters and the streets and cannot possibly solve New York City's housing crisis. But many leaders in the housing movement continue to support it. They argue that some new affordable housing is better than none, and that the program can be tweaked to produce better results. End quote. The truth is, Stein continues, cities know how to create affordable housing. The simplest, most direct, and cheapest way to do it is to build or acquire public housing, and actually maintain it well. Public housing not only provides affordable homes, but takes land off the speculative market, acting as a bulwark against gentrification. We also know that rent controls are the most effective strategy for keeping private housing prices down. The strength of rent regulation is its universality. Rather than applying to a small percentage of otherwise exorbitant housing, it can keep all rents in check. Stein advocates for democratically controlled community land trusts, which generally pairs a piece of land owned by a nonprofit with a building owned by a mutual housing association, which sells or rents the apartments at low costs and with limited outside management. If people can use these tools to take land off the market and develop permanently affordable alternatives, they can effectively decommodify their housing and reclaim community control. The solutions are out there, he notes, but the political will is not. Politicians and policymakers treat housing like a puzzle to be solved with the right balance of subsidies and profits. But affordable housing isn't a mystery, it's a contradiction.
It can't be done in a way that benefits both capital and workers in equal measure. There are ways to do it poorly but profitably. There are ways to do it well, but they're not profitable. End quote. Of course, the politicians and policymakers Stein mentions are not the only agents involved. I turn now to some selections from a 1968 essay by Ian MacDonald in International Socialism on Housing, the Struggle for Tenants Control, in which he describes a history of rent strikes in the early 20th century UK. Quote, in strike after strike, the tenants took complete control of the buildings in which they lived. At the end of the strike, the tenants often signed a clause with the landlord so that, if the landlord did not carry out the repairs properly, the tenants would take complete control of the management and would themselves collect the rents for this purpose. In at least one case in London's East End, this actually happened. The strike movement spread throughout the country and successfully pressured hostile governments to extend rent control and make other concessions to the tenants. The struggle between landlordism and tenants is a continuous one and will continue so long as the provision of housing is dominated by profits. End quote. We need housing policies and tenant organizing that confront capitalism while providing a genuine social good. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. Our last segment is another archive piece drawn from the Rural Organizing Project's podcast, Rural Roots Rising, back in 2021.
Welcome back to Rural Roots Rising. Rural Roots Rising is created by and for rural Oregonians who are creatively and courageously building stronger and more vibrant communities for a just democracy. My name is Emma Renee Derning, and I'm an organizer with the Rural Organizing Project and one of the creators of Rural Roots Rising. In today's show, we'll be highlighting Ashland High School Truth to Power Club's podcast, Tea, Toast, and Truth. The episode we're highlighting is a shortened version of their original Seeing Homeless episode, the first show that the club produced collaboratively.
There are often misconceptions around homeless people. The human psyche jumps to conclusions based on biases and stereotypes without actually recognizing homeless for who they truly are. To put this into perspective, imagine a homeless person you see on the daily when driving to work or going to the grocery store. Do you actually know anything about them? Or do you simply form an opinion on who they are based on looks and preconceptions? These two questions inspired us to go out and work on dissolving our own prejudice around houselessness. We wanted to share our journey with you in the hopes that we can all come out of it with opened eyes.
Hi, I'm Kenna.
I'm Isadora Millay, and you're listening to Tea, Toast, and Truth. This episode, Seeing Homeless, a project of Ashland High School's Truth to Power Club, teen talk that matters.
Every type of human hits the streets. I've had Wall Street brokers homeless. There have been the $10 million, you know, lottery winner, 3 years later, homeless.
Like, I wasn't expecting ever to be here, and I'm a high school graduate. I graduated with my diploma in the 4.0 and on the honor roll.
I worked hard on ships as a merchant mariner for 10 years, all through my 20s until I'm in my 30s, so I used to make really good money.
You know, when I came here 11 years ago, the homeless, because we were calling it homeless back then and not houseless or unhoused, but it was kind of the stereotypical middle-aged guy sitting down in the plaza, you know, maybe drinking a 40-ouncer in a brown paper bag. And now it's much more complex. There's financial refugees. There are people that have fled domestic violence situations. I get there's people that have fled homophobic or transphobic situations, less and less mental health resources, and more mental health problems. I think that a lot of this feeds into an increase in the unhoused population, but that's more anecdotal than scientific.
There's this form of humbling that only the travels and the harshness can teach, that people that grow up in houses and grow up with the opportunities always there, constantly growing, couldn't fathom walking day and night through pouring rain and ice cold weather for months, getting maybe an hour of sleep a night, if that. Most people can't fathom that.
When people are unhoused, they're likely in trauma on a daily basis and not knowing where their next meal's going to come from, not knowing if they're going to get woken up by the police. I'm respectful of that. It doesn't mean that I have the ability to stop doing my job, but I'm respectful of the fact that you can't do those upper level things unless you have your basic needs met.
Sleep like that you shouldn't be in trouble for trying to sleep, especially if you're not doing anything to hurt anything like that. It's like,
just messed up.
Sleep under the awning of an abandoned store that get you some charges.
One of the most inconvenient things I found is like trying to get sleep, like even if it's like not like just being worried about, I got woke up multiple times when I was sleeping in a park by the police, obviously sleeping, asleep. Mm-hmm. And then being told I have to move when I haven't slept because of not having a good spot to sleep or having to take care of getting food and the chores of life.
If it was just me, I know it easier, but I have my service dog who helps me with schizophrenia, and he means more to me than, you know, anything half the time. That me making sure he stays warm and dry as well, it matters to me as well. And it's not easy half the time to make sure you or your animal stays well dry or well fed or anything like that.
It's hard to get food sometimes. I mean, we've got free meals, but it's hard to get enough food for every day.
You don't have to hurt nobody.
One of the largest misinterpretations that many people have when it comes to those living on the streets is that it is their choice to be there. While some of the people who we talk to did have a choice in their lifestyle, others didn't. It's important to not make assumptions and group together those unhoused or to dehumanize them and their struggles. There are over 14,000 houseless people in our state. They all come from different backgrounds. They all have different beliefs and values. They are all human, like me and like you.
You don't have a social security number? Well, you're going to jail because we're going to have to figure out who you are, and you're going to have to run your fingerprints, and you never know how long you're going to be in there because you're not in the system, so you're not recognized.
Then you get to people that you can tell that they're somehow disgusted with the homeless. But in reality, the more you think about it, a lot of us don't get the choice to be out here.
This is just like a choice because of I don't have money to go through COVID, go rent out a hotel room, and it's hard to get a permanent housing and rent a house with people because it takes a lot of resources.
There's a rather narrow offering of resources. So like the gospel mission, they'll give you housing, but you're required to convert to rather strict Christianity. So you have to go to church. I think you have to quit smoking cigarettes. Some of the shelters, you're not allowed to work.
I used to make $15 an hour painting almost full time for a couple of years, and to rent a place and pay food and whatever you want to do, have a car and stuff. Like, unless you already kind of have done more, it's kind of you don't have a lot.
So you're homeless. You have no money. You have no ability within our society to fight on your own behalf. Period.
Sometimes I think that there's some people are intentionally trying to keep people impoverished.
I had this happen at me in front of 7-Eleven. A lady told me, get a job. And I said, 200 homeless people in Ashland. Find us 200 jobs in Ashland. And she went, well, I know Sandwich is hiring. Why, as a restaurant, would you ever hire someone that can't take a daily shower over someone that can?
It's like, yeah, here's a resource, but you have to fit into it rather than a community thinking, okay, the people living on the streets, there's a diversity of people, there's a diversity of needs, there's a diversity of communities. Well, what we offer and think about in our responses should be as diverse as the people.
The controversy between the police force and minority peoples reigns ever strong within our picture-perfect Ashlandia. When interviewing our local chief of police, Ty O'Meara, and a homeless and home-free rights activist, Joe Gibson, we encountered a multitude of contradicting thoughts and opinions.
My name's Ty O'Meara. I'm the Ashland Police Chief.
I do volunteer work in the community just because I can, right? Mountain Meadows community, I walk for elderly, disabled, retired, whatever, walk their dogs 2-3 hours each morning. So 7:30-ish is when I'm hitting my first person. Home free existence, traveling, nomadic, non-housed existence should be a legal and lawful lifestyle choice, as is any other lifestyle choice.
If the city framework wants to say that you can camp anywhere you want, cool. You can camp anywhere you want. Personally, I think that's a bad idea. We're doing the community's bidding.
Stop being criminal to homeless people. Like, literally, there is a Ninth Circuit District Court decision that says criminalizing sleeping when no other option is given is, in and of itself, cruel and unusual punishment. This is a crime.
A crime is something for which you can be incarcerated. You can be locked up in jail. A violation is something that is the only punishment you can get is a monetary fine. People say that we criminalize homelessness, and we don't.
Starting at midnight, they went and woke everybody up, ran their names, arrested anybody that had a warrant, and then said, oh, would you like some services? And then in the morning came back with bulldozers to quote-unquote clean up trash. But like pretty clearly this, you know, somebody comes to your house in the middle of the night with cops, wakes you up at 3 a.m, arrests your roommate, then says, oh, do you want services? And then they come back and start demolishing the home, the tent of the person they arrested the day before. It's pretty clear what's going on. It's not resources. It's not cleanup. It's just terrorizing people.
I think that we're at the front of the line for people to blame because we are the most obvious representative of society, of the city. We're the enforcement arm that is tasked with dealing with these issues. So I suspect that they view us as the problem and they view us as the enemy, when in fact we are simply tasked with enforcing the framework that the legislative body sets up.
The tools that police have are criminalization, harassment, violence, and so anything they do, even if their narrative is I'm helping people, the only tools they have are, you know, if all you have is a chainsaw, you're going to cut everything down. You know, so I think basically it's a war on poor people, and they're the frontline soldiers.
The houseless population is suffering because of our government and society's ineptitude at trying to figure out how to deal with the issue.
Despite many people's attempts to make this a police versus homeless picture, that's not accurate. We are not the decision makers. We are the enforcers of somebody else's decisions.
It is the fact that city administration is actively stopping the people who want to be the solutions from being able to do so. It's all policy change. So this is what I've been telling everyone. What can I do to help you? Write a letter, write an email, make a phone call, look into things online as far as what is a solution, and try to push for that.
We hope that your eyes have been opened to many of the adversities homeless face, so that your empathy and compassion awakens. We hope you're ready to make Ashland a beacon of hope for the homeless. We hope you're ready to see them for who they truly are. You've been listening to Tea, Toast, and Truth.
You've been listening to Rural Roots Rising, and this month's episode, Community Media Spotlight, Tea, Toast, and Truth. We featured music from Daniel Birch and the Road Sodas. Rural Roots Rising is created by the Rural Organizing Project, a network of more than 80 autonomous groups who are advancing democracy and human dignity across rural Oregon. To learn more about the Rural Organizing Project, go to rop.org. If you liked what you heard today, you can find more episodes at ruralrootsrising.org. To donate to sustain our work, amplifying the voices of rural organizers, visit rop.org/donate. Thanks so much for listening.
And thanks so much for listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host for today's episode. Thanks very much to Sandra Comstock, Joe Clement, and the Rural Organizing Project, all of the Moles, and all of KBOO's staff, volunteers, members, and listeners. You can find audio and more information about our show at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also click on the red Donate tab to support your nonprofit community radio station.
City. They kicked us from the door. I said the rich man took my home and he drove me from my door. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Ain't got no home, ain't got no home. Ain't got no home in this world anymore. Cause the rich man took my home and he drove me from my door. And I ain't got no home in this world.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Coming this Monday at 2 p.m., the Monday Sampler presents part 3 of Ian Fleming's Goldfinger.
They're all gone, Mr. Bond. I will tell you the truth, because you'll have no opportunity of passing it on.